Good morning, everybody. We are not going to talk about the deadline today. I've handed out all of the handouts, so you should be able to read and acquaint yourself with it. It'll take a few weeks until we, in fact, study that. We have a lot to do before we get to that. I gave you these handouts in order that I should have thereby committed myself to studying it with you. That should be around there. More than enough for everybody. Layla, come here. You're getting on the
phone.
Now, I'm just going to use the globe now for one moment in order to point out what the story is all about. Take any point that you want on the globe. Let's see.
Like Israel.
Yeah, there's Israel. You can hardly see. Take any point on the globe. There are 360 degrees. Every 90 degrees, the time changes by 6 hours. 3 times 90 equals?
270.
Huh?
270.
4 times?
360.
360. That means every degree, the time changes by 4 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Every 15 degrees, the time changes by an hour. Because of, according to the way we see it, the sun is moving. In truth, the sun isn't moving, but the globe is moving. But it's always easier to talk about the sun moving, right? The sun rises and the sun sets, even though we're in the post-Copernican era, at which we know that it's not the sun that moves. But we know that it's the earth that moves, but it's still so much easier to talk about the sun rising and the sun setting. So we're going to do precisely that as well. Now, if you take this point over here, is it Israel?
No.
This is Israel, okay? Now, 90 degrees to the west of Israel, let's say it's 12 o'clock in Israel. Let's say it's, you know, it's easier to talk about 6, 12, 12, 6. Let's say it's high noon right now in Eretz Yisrael. To the west, 90 degrees to the west, someplace in the Atlantic or off the coast of Brazil, or in Brazil already, 90 degrees to the west, it's 6 hours earlier. In Brazil now, the sun is rising. If we talk about a normal day, sun rises at 6, sunset is at 6, high noon is at 12. So right now, make believe it's 12 o'clock right here in Arizona. So 6 hours further, 90 degrees further, the day is just beginning. 90 degrees to the east of Arizona, China, Japan, there, it's 6 hours earlier, so they, later, see what I need you? So they are already coming to, they're at 6 o'clock in the evening. The sun is setting. When the sun is at high noon in Eretz Yisrael, it's setting in China, it's rising in Brazil. Now, let's say, There are a number of ways to do this. Let's say two people start out from Israel. One traveling to the west, and the other one traveling to the east. And they're going to come back, they're going to girdle the globe, not in 80 days, but in 24 hours. And the two of them are going to come back to the place where they started from. For one, it'll be Sunday, and for the other, it'll be Monday. Or, if that's too confusing, let's figure out. Let's keep going. If we go 90 degrees to the west, to Brazil, it's at 6 o'clock in the morning. We go another 90 degrees, it's going to be midnight. We go another 90 degrees, it's going to be 6 o'clock the evening before. If we go another, the last 90 degrees, I come back to the place that I started. But 24 hours have passed. There has to be another day. In other words, wherever one is on the face of this earth, precisely where I'm standing is one day, and one step behind me is 24 hours earlier. Which, of course, is an impossible situation to live with. And therefore, the nations of the world went ahead and they drew an imaginary line down through the middle of the Pacific, and it avoids all sorts of islands, and they call that the international dateline. And if you go one way, you add a day, you go the other way, you lose a day, and that's how we make sure that we are able to maintain the inescapable fact. The words that are going to be used by the Kuzari is Logi Mullet. There is no getting away from it that there are 2 days going on the face of this earth at the same time. Now, so the nations of the world, about 150, 200 years ago or so, came up with the international deadline so that it doesn't upset anybody's, nobody's life is upset. And it doesn't go through a town. If it would go through a town or through a country, it would mean that one half of the town is going to go to Kabbalah Shabbos, you understand? And the other ones on the other side of the street will be the Shabbos going for them, because by then it's not Shabbos. But what's important to us is, can we rely on an international deadline, or is there a halachic deadline? The amount that has been written on this issue in the last 100 years is awesome. Why indeed in the last 100 years? Because travel has made it possible for people to move through the world a great deal more quickly. Even in the 19th century, or we have toward the end of the 19th century, Gedolei Yisrael wrote that they went by boat from San Francisco to Yokohama. And you know, they put up a sign someplace on the boat, they put on a sign in the middle of the ocean that today has changed. One way, and the other way, the other way. We'll talk about that later, not now. And then, of course, when the Second World War came and Jews fled from Lithuania and they made their way to Vladivostok and then to Kobe, Japan, the Shiloh became not only when is Shabbos, the Shiloh became when is Kippur. Because we're traveling. We move quickly through the world. I mean, the amount of travel between the United States and China and Japan is pretty long. It's going on all the time. You'll see from the article in Kosher Currents that there are Ajigim who are constantly in China and Japan. I mean, we even have on the third floor up here, I know that you people never make it up really to the inner sanctum of the third floor unless there's some kind of a something happening out on the sukkah porch. But they have the head of kashrus of the Odu here who's every 2 weeks he's in Japan. When we finally talk about it, I'll tell you how he conducts himself with regards to Shabbos. It's very fascinating. There are two points that are going to be important with this end, and we go back to what we have to do. The two points that we will make is that one of the first who dealt with this issue, and I wouldn't be even surprised if they even had dealt with the issue before world geographers, was Rabbi Dalai. In all the voluminous studies in Halacha that have been made, every article begins, every discussion, every sefer begins with the opinion of the Kuzari. Now, that part I want to point out is, it's not only a book of philosophy, The state of Veracruz is also a state in which there are major contributions to our water. This is the greatest one of them all. There are a number of others, and we as Hashem will deal with them as well. That's number one. And number two, I just wanted you to know that there are a lot of issues facing the world at large that Chach VeYisrael, the wise men of Israel, dealt with them. These were dealt with. They were dealt with. But the first one who dealt with the dateline was clearly Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and Christian. That having been said, I think I've given you enough information so that you should be able to understand, not completely, but get a general idea of what appears in these two articles. You have a few weeks, and until we get to it, I'll give you 1 week's warning. In other words, next week, in Yiras Hashem, I'll remind you that you have two articles to read, right? And then when it comes to the Wednesday before the time I want to deal with it, I'm going to tell you next Wednesday is it. I would always suggest that it's best to do your homework well in advance so that you'll be able to read it and reread it. Doesn't it feel great being back in school?
Yes.
Is press?
Uh-huh. We are beginning, today we're beginning the second essay. The second essay is going to bring us into most probably the issue or the area of Hashkafa, the area of Jewish thought that in the minds of most people defines and describes Rabbi Yehuda Halevi more than any other. Let's see, essay two. In your.
Here we go.
Part two, page 82. We're going to read the introduction. We're going to skip a bit. I'm going to move you through it, and I'll point out all sorts of things that have to be pointed out. Wait, I just have to open up my Hebrew edition. I have to have the Hebrew is makes me feel more secure. After this, after all the discussions that took place in the first essay, as is related in the history of the Khazars. Page 82. The king, that is, was anxious to reveal to his vizier in the mountains of Warsan the secret of his dream and his repetition, in which he was urged to seek the God-pleasing deed. In other words, everything that was discussed in the first essay has finally made an impression on the king, and the king now feels that he has to share the revelations that he has made. He has to share them with his grand vizier. The king and his vizier traveled to the deserted mountains on the seashore and arrived one night at the cave in which some Jews used to celebrate the Sabbath. They disclosed their identity to them, embraced their religion, were circumcised in the cave, and then returned to their country eager to learn the Jewish law. They kept their conversion secret, however, when they came back, they didn't tell anybody that they had converted until they found an opportunity of disclosing the fact gradually to a few of their special friends. They understood that this is not something that you can just pull on a whole nation, especially since their intent is that the king wants all of his people to convert to Judaism, so he waits for the appropriate time. Little by little, they started telling people. When the number had increased, they made the affair public and induced the rest of the Khazars to embrace the Jewish faith. They sent to various countries for scholars and books and studied the Torah. Their chronicles also tell of their prosperity, how they beat their foes, conquered their lands, secured great treasures, how their army swelled to hundreds of thousands. We're talking about a major upheaval in world and Jewish history. So ultimately they were wiped out. Ultimately they were wiped out. You know, There were no lack of so many slaughter at that point in history as well. How they loved their faith and fostered such love for the holy house that they erected a tabernacle in the shape that was built by Moses. They built a mishkan of their own. They also honored and cherished those born Israelites who lived among them. While the king studied the Torah and the books of the prophets, he employed the rabbi as his teacher and put many questions to my Hebrew mentors. The first of these questions referred to the names and attributes ascribed to God and their anthropomorphistic forms, which are unmistakably objectionable alike both to reason and to law. We're not going to deal with this issue now. We may at some later date. Notice he's going to explain to him the meaning of all the various names of God and how it is that Torah speaks about God as though he is a physical being, when we know that that's not true. The Torah speaks of the hand of God, the might of God, the eyes of God. All right. So that's two, and we're going to move from two. We're going to move to number nine. During the course of this discussion and in previous discussions, the king, the chaver, the Talmud Chacham, had made reference to the fact that the Jewish people are God's people, his people. But he had also thrown into the conversation something about the land of Israel as being his country. So on page 88, number 9, the king says, I understand what you mean by his people. But less intelligible is, what do you mean about his country? What do you mean, his country? To which the rabbi responds, forgive me if I change the English into
yeah,
no, that's quite all right. 19th or 20th century English. You'll have no difficulty in understanding that one country may have higher qualifications than others. Countries are different. There are places in which particular plants, metals, or animals are found, or where the inhabitants are distinguished by their form and character, since perfection or deficiency of the soul are produced by the mingling of the elements. So, different people in different places grow different people, different temperaments, you know. That's the way it is. So the king says, yet I never heard that the inhabitants of Palestine were better than other people. That people from different climates and different places on the face of this earth are different, yes. But you've intimated that the people of Eretz Yisrael are better. Not just different, but better. To which the rabbi responds, how about the hill on which you say that the vines thrive so well? The place where the Khazars lived was land that was particularly suited for the growing of grapes. If it had not been properly planted and cultivated, it would never produce grapes. When we say that a land has the potential to produce good grapes. If you plant, then you would take care of it. Priority belongs in the first instance to the people, which, as stated before, is the essence of the kernel of nations. He is now repeating the idea that ran like a fine thread in the first essay, which was, don't forget what I told you, that the genes of Adam went down to Avram, from Avram to Yitzhak, from Yitzhak to Yaakov, and from Yaakov to the 12 tribes. Priority belongs in the first instance to the people, which, as stated before, is the essence and the kernel of the nations. In the second instance, it would belong to the country on account of the religious acts connected with it, which I would compare to the cultivation of the vineyard. Just like you cultivate a vineyard, you cultivate a people. And the cultivation of the people are the mitzvot that they perform. No other place would share the distinction of the divine influence, just as no other mountain might be able to produce good wine. He's saying something a little deeper than it seems at the outset. He's obviously differentiating between between the Jew who performs a mitzvah in America and the Jew who performs a mitzvah in Eretz Yisrael. Rashi and Rambam say it in Chumash that in a certain sense the fulfillment of mitzvah in Chutz La'aretz is so that Jews shouldn't forget mitzvah and be able to fulfill them when they return. But the main place for the fulfillment of mitzvahs is here, and only through the fulfillment of mitzvahs in Eretz Yisrael can Israel achieve their true greatness. So the king in number 13 says, how could this be? In the time between Adam and Moses, were not prophetic visions in other places granted to Abraham in Ur of the Chaldees, Ezekiel and Daniel at Babylon, and Jeremiah in Egypt? The impression that was left by the Chaver, the Talmud Chacham, and that's exactly what he had in mind, was that one achieves this spiritual perfection. One achieves this spiritual perfection in Eretz Yisrael to the point where one is able to receive prophecy. So the king asks him, but wait a minute, there are Jews who received prophecy outside of Eretz Yisrael. Avram, it seems, received a message while he was out in Ur of the Chaldees. God told him, Lech that command had to be given to the Chutzlars. Go to the land that I will show you. Yechezkel received prophecy in Babel. Daniel prophesied in Babel. Yirmiyahu, toward the end of his life, when they took him down to Egypt, he received prophecy. There are prophecies that Yirmiyahu say God appeared to him in the land of Egypt. So how can you tell me that the land of prophecy, where Jews achieve their unique greatness, is only Eretz Yisrael? Here comes one of the great statements of the Kuzri that everybody quotes afterwards. Anybody who deals with prophecy, this is it. By the way, it also applies to Yonah. When Yonah is spat out by the whale, he's not in Eretz Yisrael. And God appears to him and then tells him, go to Nineveh and tell Nineveh, oh, our boy in Yom, the Nineveh, Ne'epachet. In another 40 days, Nineveh is going to be destroyed. That's not enough of an answer. He's going to say, whoever said prophecy outside of Eretz Yisrael, it was either because of Eretz Yisrael, or that he had begun to prophesy in Eretz Yisrael. Avraham Avinu's first prophecy was clearly the first great step that Jews make toward arriving in Eretz Yisrael. Whoever prophesied did so either in the Holy Land or concerning it. Abraham in order to reach it. Yechezkel and Daniel on account of it. They were talking about, what was Yechezkel talking about? Yechezkel was talking about Binyan Bayitshushi, the Geula. There's so much that Yechezkel and Daniel are both talking about the return to Eretz Yisrael, the Geula, the ultimate return. And now he goes on. The two latter had lived during the time of the first temple, had seen the Shekhinah through the influence of which each one was duly prepared. Become of the elect and able to prophesy. Now, he is also adding the point that Yechezkel and Daniel had already been in Eretz Yisrael, and that influence of Eretz Yisrael, coupled with the fact that they are prophesying about Eretz Yisrael. Adam, you may not have known this, Adam lived and died in the land. And then Adam HaRishon lived in Eretz Yisrael. What other connection does Adam have to Eretz Yisrael? He's buried there. Adam and Chava are buried in the Ma'arat HaMakpelah. Tradition tells us that in the cave of Machpelah were buried the four pairs, Adam and Chava, Avraham and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, Yaakov and Leah. This is the land which bore the name before the Lord. Before the Lord. Here you read the Hebrew. Eretz Yisrael is called Lifnei Hashem. Vayakom Yona Libroach Tarshisha Milifnei Hashem. Yonah arose to flee to Tarshish, Milifnei Hashem, from being before God. Because he assumed that prophecy would only be while he was in the presence of God. And where is he in the presence of God? That is in Eretz Yisrael. So therefore the land is called before the Lord, and of which it is stated that Eine Hashem Elokecha Ba Meveshit Shomadi Acharit Shona. Moshe Rabbeinu tells the Jewish people that the eyes of God are in this land from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. It was also the first object of jealousy and envy between Cain and Abel. Kusri says the struggle between Cain and Abel was over who, to whom does Eretz Yisrael belong? Nothing has changed in 5,764 days. The struggle between Cain and Abel, when they desired to know which of them would be Adam's successor and heir to his essence and intrinsic perfection. Who was the one that was going to be in place of Adam? To Cain, it becomes clear as a result of the fact that God accepts his sacrifice that Hebel is the one who carries the genes of Adam. And therefore he's going to have Eretz Yisrael. So he does most probably what anybody in his position would have done. He kills him. Right? People have been doing that for all of these years. To inherit the land. That was the question. The question between Cain and Abel was to inherit the land. And to stand in connection with the divine influence. Who is going to be related to that great divine influence? Whilst the other would be a non-entity. And Cain understood that he was going to be the non-entity. Then Abel was killed by Cain. And the realm was without an heir. There is nobody in the world now to take over the place of Abel. It is stated that Cain, when Cain is banished from Gan Eden, says he went out milifnei Hashem, before God. You know what it means? He is sent out of Eretz Yisrael. Because that was the land that was smashed down. Behold, he says, thou hast driven me out this day from the face of the earth, and from thy face shall I be hid. Let me see if I have that pasuk correct. Yeah. Lee? Right here, then, huh? That's right. Pain de rashto tihayon. You have cast me out. You expel me today, me al pnei ha'adamah, from upon the face of the earth. And from your face I will be hidden. Just one moment. I lost my ear. In the same way, it is said, but Jonah rose up to flee unto Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. But he only fled from the place of prophecy. Nobody can flee from before God, because Moly called Horex to go to the whole. The whole earth is full of his glory. So what does it mean that Jonah is fleeing from before God? What it means is from before the place where the essential nature of God's prophecy can be. God, however, brought him back there out of the belly of the fish and appointed him prophet of the land. He became later a prophet of real sorts. When his shape was born, he was like Adam, as it is said. He gave birth to somebody in his own likeness, after his image. And now Shape is the one who takes Hebel's place. As it is said, for God has appointed me another seed instead of Abel, whom Cain slew. She said, I now have somebody in place of Hebel. He merited the title Son of God. like Adam, and he had a claim on the land, which is the next step to paradise. After Eretz Yisrael comes Gan Eden. The land was then the object of jealousy between Yitzchak and Ishmael. Says that was the real struggle. The real struggle was the struggle between Kayin and Hebel, and now becomes the struggle between Yitzchak and Ishmael. And the fact is, it's going to be the same struggle between Yaakov and Esau. Who has Eretz Yisrael? Who has Eretz Yisrael? I once said that I believe it's at the end of Parashat Vayishlach, it says that Esau, when he saw that the women that he had married did not find favor in the eyes of his parents, Yitzchak and Midgar, he went to Yishmael and he married the daughter of Ishmael. Mind you, he did not send away his previous wives, because it says in addition to his previous wives, he now married a daughter of Ishmael. And I once explained, you know why he marries the daughter of Ishmael? Now, he's going to have a double claim on Eretz Yisrael. He's going to claim it because he's related to Yishmael, who's the son of Avram, and he is the son of Yitzchak, who is the son of Avram. So he's going to have a double claim. It means, therefore, that the claim of the nations of the world, like the claim of Ishmael, is. You see? This is not ancient history, this is all absolute current events. That's what it is. The land was then the object of jealousy between Yitzchak and Yishmael. Till the latter, Yishmael was rejected as worthless, although it was said concerning him, behold, I have blessed him and will multiply it exceedingly. Unfortunately, God gave that bracha to Yishmael. It's most probably the smallest nation on the face of this earth is pitted against the most prolific of all. Yeah. So instead, if you really want to look at this passage most seriously, it means that God already said that there would be a demographic problem.
Yeah.
He said it all the way in Torah. It's not something new that every day you have another fellow saying, boy, within 10 years we're going to be overrun.
Yeah.
We already tried to overrun us already since the days of Yitzchak and Ishmael. And you know what? They haven't done it. They haven't done it yet. And Esau is going to have worldly prosperity. But after it is said, my covenant is going to be with Yitzchak, which refers to his connection with the divine influence and happiness of the world to come. The Inyan Eloki, divine influence, is that which is natural to Yitzchak and not to Ishmael. Neither Ishmael nor Esau could ever boast of a covenant with God, although they were otherwise prosperous. They had many people, they were wealthy. Jealousy arose between Yaakov and Esau for the birthright and blessings, but Esau was rejected in favor of Yaakov. He in fact is repeating the theme of the first essay. In spite of his strength, despite the fact that Esau was strong and Yaakov was weak. Jeremiah's prophecy concerning Egypt was uttered in Egypt itself. This was also the case with Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. They also prophesied not inside Eretz Yisrael, but it was about Eretz Yisrael. Except that here, he expresses what is a unique, unique position of the Kuzari, which is open to a great deal of debate. He says, Sinai and Paran are reckoned as belonging to Palestine.
Yes, yes.
It is an extremely, this is of course an extreme right-wing position, because there is a machloket, what is the southern boundary of Eretz Yisrael? Many of the Rishonim and Achronim say that it's Vadi El Arish. Vadi El Arish, a description. The southern border of Eretz Yisrael, according to Torah, is what's called in Torah Nahal Mitzrayim. The river or the Wadi of Mitzrayim. Is that in northern Sinai or is that in southern Sinai? So many of the poskim say it's in southern Sinai. Vadi El Arish is below Rafiach. It's In other words, which of course means that Gush Katif and Azar are all within the boundaries of Eretz Israel. The Khusri takes the position, the maximalist position, which is that all of Sinai was part of Eretz Israel, and since all of Sinai is part of Eretz Israel, then there's really no problem with Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam having prophecy, because what they say as prophecy in the Sinai desert is really already within the biblical confines of Eretz Israel. But what I said earlier is, according to those who hold that Badi El Adish, northern Sinai, is the border. So the same thing that applies to Yirmiyahu in Egypt and Yechezkel and Daniel in Babylon would apply to Moshe and Aaron, because they were all prophesying about Eretz Yisrael because of Eretz Yisrael in order to bring them into Eretz Yisrael. And he says, because he's more clear, because it's because they are on this side of the Red Sea. The Red Sea, in other words, there's a Nahal. The Torah uses the term Nahal. A Nahal is either a river or a body of water, or a wadi is really a place where there was a Nahal, where there was a river. So it's either Wadi El Adish in North Sinai, or it's the Yamsuf down at the Zion. And I will set my bounds from the Red Sea, even unto the Sea of the Philistines, and from the desert unto the river. The desert is that of Horam. Here he is outlining his position with regard to the biblical boundaries of Eretz Israel. That great and terrible wilderness, that's being the southern border. That's what he sees. The fourth river, at the beginning in Bereshit, it says the fourth river is the Euphrates. That's up in Mesopotamia. That's the northern border. Desert makes the northern border, where there were the altars of the patriarchs who were answered by fire from heaven and the divine light. The binding of his Isaac took place on a desolate mountain, Moriah. Now, he's back to his description of the uniqueness of the land. He's trying to explain to the king, just as you know that the mountain upon which you live is the kind of land that is really uniquely suited for planting good vines and grapes. So now take a look. He's telling you more about Eretz Israel. Not till the days of David, when it was inhabited, was the secret revealed that it was the place specially prepared for the Shema. This is an important. What a sentence. Now, he throws so much into one sentence. We once discussed this at length in some sheer, I don't know how many years ago already. Yerushalayim is not mentioned in all of Torah, except in a reference in Parashat Lech Lecha, when it says Melchizedek, the king of Shalem, came out toward Aram when he returned from the battle against the four kings. And Targum Onkelos says Melchizedek, Malka, the king of Yerushalayim. How is Yerushalayim referred to in Torah? Last time I counted, it was about 20 times. The Torah repeats, Hamakom Asher Yivchar Hashem Elokecha L'shaken Shmo Sham, the place that God will choose to have his divine presence rested. There you should bring your sacrifices, there you should build the Beit HaMikdash. Now, it would seem like it's an open secret where the place was, but Torah never refers to it by name. Always the place that God will choose. And we gave a whole shiur on the significance of not revealing the name, and he says that this is the place was not revealed until the days of David HaMelech. The Rambam says, in the Guide to the Perplexed, the Rambam Gemara gives a number of reasons why Yerushalayim is not designated by name until the time of David. So he says, first of all, because if the enemy would know that we plan on making this our capital city, they would, one, put up a battle that who knows how many Jews would fall in battle, because there's always the most difficult battles always were fought over capital cities. What happened? Battle for Berlin is there. They pushed it, destroyed Berlin. Not good enough, but they destroyed Berlin. Alright? The Rambam says, in the event that there was also the possibility, in the event that the enemy would see that they're going to lose the city to the hands of Israel, they would institute a scorched earth policy and they would destroy the city unto its very foundations. In sheer, in Al-Naharos Babel, in Al-Naharos Babel, we talk about Esau, who at the time of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash said, Oru, Oru, destroy, destroy, Ad HaYisoba, until the very foundations, destroy the city to its very foundations. According to the Rambam also, it was not revealed so that there should not be strife amongst the tribes. Who is going to be the one that will have the capital city in their portion? So if that's what he meant in this one line, not till the days of David, when it was inhabited, was the secret revealed that it was the place especially prepared for Shinnah. I don't know how to read that, but it's Aravna. Aravna, the Jebusite, tilled his land there, and David bought it from Aravna, the Jebusite. I'm getting ruined over here reading this English, understand? The Yebusi. Have you ever heard of Zebulun?
Yeah.
Try that for a few times. Try saying that a few times. See if you can get used to it. Yeah, you heard it a lot in class, right? Zebulun. Zebulun the Jebusite. Issachar. Okay. All right. Thus it is said, and Abraham called the name of the place the Lord shall see, as it was said to this day, in the mountain of the Lord it shall be seen. This is the famous pasuk in the at the end of the Keder. By Yikra Avram called the name of the place Hashem Yireh. God shall be seen. Which place? That was the Temple Mount, Hamoria. In the book of Chronicles, it is stated more clearly that the temple was built on Mount Moriah. It says it in Divrei Hayomim. These are without doubt the places where they have been called the gates of heaven. When Yaakov, he will describe how Yaakov, when he has his dreams, he says, "Ein zekim shar hashamayim." This is the very gates to heaven, and this is Beth Elohim, and he's talking about Yerushalayim. Don't you see that Yaakov ascribed the vision which he saw not to the purity of his soul, nor to his belief, nor to true integrity, but to the place. This place is different than all other places on the face of this earth. How awful is this place? Awful once was a positive word. Understand?
Full of
awe. How awesome. That's what we would say today. We would not. How awesome. Manoha hamakom hazeh, Yaakov says. How awesome is this place. Prior to this, it is said, and he lighted upon a certain place. Vayivga hamakom vayolet sham. He came to the place and he lived there. Was not Avram also, after having been greatly exalted, brought into contact with divine influence and made the heart of this essence removed from his country to the place in which his perfection should become complete? Don't you understand, King of the Cosmos? Why do you think God told Avram to leave his land and come to the land of Canaan? Because this is the place where Avram would achieve his true greatness. It's only possible in Eretz Yisrael, no other place. Thus, the agriculturer finds the root of good tree in a desert place. He says, an example of this is the agriculture. A farmer finds a good tree growing in a desert. You know what you do? You take it out and you bring it to good, verdant earth, and you replanted there. Avram was out there in the exile, and the revelation brought him to earth's soil and planted him there. He transplants it into properly tilled ground to improve it and make it grow. To change it from a wild fruit into a cultivated one. From one which bore fruit by chance only to one which produced a luxuriant crop. That's what God is saying to him. Lech lecha me'arzecha u'milatcha mi'beit avicha el ha'aretz to the land asher ha'echa, where I will show you what you can really be. And echo doesn't mean the land that I'm going to show you. If that's what the Torah meant, it should have said, Asher ani ar'echa, that I can show you. Ar'echa is I'm going to show you what you can be. Avram is going to achieve his real greatness in this land. In the same way, the gift of prophecy was retained among Abraham's descendants in Eretz Yisrael. The property of many, as long as they remained in the land and fulfilled the requirements, high conditions. There was prophecy by Klal Yisrael as long as the Jewish people were in Eretz Yisrael, and they had to maintain the level of observance. Fulfill the required conditions, purity, worship, sacrifices, and above all, the reverence of the Shema. For the divine influence, one might say, singles out him who appears worthy of being connected, such as prophets and pious men, and is their God. Reason chooses those whose natural gifts are perfect, beautiful. If we choose somebody who's good, you know, we take a look at what the man's IQ is, understand? What he looks like, but not so. Reason chooses those whose natural gifts are perfect. For example, philosophers and those whose souls and character are so harmonious that it can find its dwelling among them. The spirit of life, pure and simple, is found in beings which are endowed with ordinary primary faculties and particularly adapted to higher vitality, such as animals. Finally, organic life finds its habitat in a mixture of harmonious elements and produces plants. I'm going to explain all of this. He has just now mentioned this is we'll take a little bit more to explain, but I just want to, before we leave, he has pointed out that there are there's a hierarchy in nature. If we are to start from the bottom, it's the domain, the inanimate object, rock, earth. Then there is the tzomeach, that which grows, that which grows. Above it is the chai, that which lives, the animal kingdom. Above that is Adam, the human being. There may be one higher level, but we're not going to talk about that today. The one higher level is Yisrael or the Navi. Stands higher than the ordinary human being. All right, we continue next week.